Hello, my name is Hamlet Dobbins, and this is Memphis Material, an oral history project chronicling the stories of the visual arts in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis Material is a podcast celebrating the personal histories, intimate stories, and the studio practices of some of the people who help shape the creative landscape of our city. These unedited interviews are all recorded at the Memphis Listening Lab at Crosstown Concourse. The website is designed by the wonderful Brian Dixon. This interview is the second of three interviews that I've done with Carol DeForest. This interview was recorded on February 5th, 2023. Enjoy the interview. So I re-listened to the interview that we did last time, and a couple of things that I was thinking about, you can hear the sound of me like flipping through my little notebook. So you were talking about, there were several things that you were talking about that I wanted to kind of follow up on, but they're all kind of towards the end. And so one thing that you said was there was 5 years in between the end of Southwestern and the beginning of your grad time. And then you said something real quick, blah, blah, 5 years. And then I went back in, blah, blah, blah. What did you do during that 5 years? That's a big thing for a lot of my students. It's like, what do I do the first year out of school?
Oh, boy. When I graduated from Southwestern, I sold everything I owned. I had a couple of little Oriental rugs, the obligatory stereo, typewriter, car, and I went to Europe with my boyfriend, hitchhiking all over Europe for 3 months. Bought, Southwestern had 2 tickets that kids were not going to use on their charter or just their planned flight of Rhodes at Oxford program. Mm-hmm. And so my boyfriend and I bought the 2 tickets, which meant we had to go on X day and stay until Y day. Which was good and bad, because it was, I had lived in Germany very briefly, 3 months when I was 17. And then, so this was a chance to go back and see those people 5 years later, more or less, and then just to see everything and do everything. And my father nearly had heart failure at the idea of his child hitchhiking all over Europe with this guy. And they lived in Houston at the time, he and my mother, and he picked up every hitchhiker he saw for the whole summer because he wanted to know, why are you doing this?
Oh, that's interesting.
It was very cool. I loved it that he did that. And it was a time when things were not, I mean, weren't really going to pick up a thug or a killer, probably.
Right.
You might be picking up somebody smoking reefer or, you know, hungry or with their dog or whatever, but he did all that. And so off we went, landing in London, and the first thing we did was to look up a friend from Southwestern, a writer named Steve Stern.
Okay.
And knew what he was up to. He was with a group called Interaction. One of the people in it lives here upstairs, Angie Kirkpatrick. And it was the first time that I ever experienced theater in the street, real impromptu performance art. This is 71. And in addition, they were all squatting in houses in an area called Chalk Farm in London, which is right next to Hampstead Heath. So it was a whole area that was under urban... tear everything down.
Right.
Urban renewal.
Right.
And so one house had electricity, one had water, one had, you know, et cetera. So none of them really were, could stay free, of course, because they did. And they would have puppeteers and musicians and theater people and dancers and so forth in the streets in these very poor areas. So they brought their art to the streets, literally. And so that's where we landed first and then, you know, went on and hitchhiked all over the place and had a few kind of wild scrapes, but some quite big adventure. So we came back from that and I had been...
Wait, hang on. So you were there in Europe at that age after getting a degree in art. Talk to me about some of the things that you saw.
Okay, so we... I remember most distinctly being in Amsterdam because the Van Gogh Museum was spectacular. And there was, it was a real boheme scene there too. Of course, reefer and drugs and all that too. But it was stunningly wonderful to go to museums in Amsterdam and see the artwork. And they were... They were virtually free in those days. So there was no baloney like $25 to get in and then $25 per show, per, you know, like the, now if you go to the Tate Modern, I mean, you could pay $100 for one day. I mean, it's shocking. And so anyway, this was a different era, obviously. And so that was stellar to be there. And, I mean, we were very aware that we were part of something kind of big, which was this whole, it was in a sense like the pandemic where you realize you're part of the world. Mm. And this was a flip side of a kind of more complicated culture in the midst of changing. People were saying, you know, basically, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. They were out there on the streets hitchhiking. They were figuring out ways to live. And many of them were artists or what, like those people at Chalk Farm. Their group was called Interaction. So here we are all over Europe. And, I mean, in Florence, for example, we went there. I had a friend from high school. This is really a harebrained story. He had just graduated from business school at Duke. Had decided from being there the summer before that in the hot time of the year when lots of kids and other tourists were there, there was nothing cold. There was no ice. That was just like unknown. So he bought a frozen Coca-Cola machine, like an icy machine, and got permission from a guy who had a tiny little stall of a shop at the end, one end of the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, and he sold frozen Coca-Cola there. This guy not only paid for the machine, which was around $3,000 and the shipping to get it there, but he made a very nice profit, had a great summer, met all these people, and at the end sold the machine to the man who let him set up shop outside of his little stall. And John Wagodski, this guy that had been my friend since I was in the seventh grade, had he and his partner in this deal had rented a villa, and it was extraordinary, a beautiful old, you know, like 17-foot ceilings and silk curtains and damask furniture, all blah, blah, blah. So here we are. We are totally road weary, tired, dirty, worn out, not really broke quite, but almost. And we arrive and there we are in a villa in Florence. So we could stay there and go to the Uffizi and, you know, everywhere, which we did. And it was, you know, it was a phenomenal experience. We lucked out. So we, went from there to Germany where I had lived. And I was out of money. I was going, holy cow, I've got $20 in one American Express check left, traveler's check. And I went into a little bank in the town where I had lived. There was a guy in there with a gigantic afro. I mean, like that kind. And super skinny British guy in... He was clearly a musician of some sort, you know, with really out there clothes and jewelry and all that. And the people in the bank were so wigged out that when they handed me my money and I walked out, they had handed me Deutsche Marks for $200, not 20. They had my passport. They had my name. I mean, they had everything. Never contacted me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just see this as a gift for now. I've been given $200 so I can make it for the next few weeks, couple of weeks.
Right.
I mean, this was, you know, Europe on $5 a day era. So we actually left Germany and went to Amsterdam. That was the big ta-da-da-da. And, but we, you know, we had to get back to London at some point. So it was this kind of crazy era. When we got back to Memphis, I had been accepted to the University of Georgia for grad school. And I went, okay, this is not good. I have no money, no car, no possessions, no plans. I don't know what I would even do in grad school. And I didn't realize that's why you're there. Mm. I thought you were supposed to have a whole idea of your trajectory. I didn't know that you were supposed to come in and go, what the heck am I doing? I don't figure it out. So I called him and told him I couldn't come. I said, I have no money. I can't come. And Lon had gone there. Lon Anthony had gone there to grad school. And so there was a little, you know, legacy kind of thing. Daisy Craddock, one of my roommates, did go. And she got her MFA and so forth. But what I did, I worked at a printing company. I was their night shift. So I would come in at 3 o'clock in the morning and do anything they needed me to do. There was a guy, an Iranian guy, who worked there too. He would come pick me up at 3 a.m. If he didn't happen to be working, I would literally walk from my house, which was on North Belvedere, just two blocks away past the then Montese's, and go, I mean, you know, this is insane, right? I would never do it now. But that being said, job. So after a little while, my then boyfriend, later husband, decided we would go to Austin, Texas, where I could go to grad school, get this, $50 a semester, not per hour or per class, $50, period. So off we go to Austin. We have no money. We're just, you know, like, what the heck are we going to do? We figure out quickly that it's expensive. $7.50 a month for rent then, 1972 or whatever. We got married about a minute before we left, and which was totally stupid, but anyway. And decided that we should take a trip to Mexico first before we went to Austin. It's just nuts. We drove a 1962 Chevy station wagon from Memphis to Oaxaca, Mexico, and had 5 gallons of water, maybe 4 or 5 gallons of gas, a replacement for every part in the car, literally, and very little else. And we had a friend we were dropping off for language school in Cuernavaca. So off we go, and we do this because we thought, after grad school or in grad school, after it starts, we're going to be tethered to Austin, Texas. So that was one chapter. Got back, and the two people I was supposed to work with at the University of Texas were both on leave. It's like, wait a second, the sculpture teacher is gone and the ceramics teacher is gone? What WTF? Wow. And so I was told I probably should just take art history classes. So I did. And after 2 semesters, I said, I hate this. I hate being this poor. I hate being this kind of, what am I doing? This is crazy. I told Smith, the guy I was married to, I think we should go back to Tennessee, to Jackson, where your parents live, and run their grocery business. that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. You don't know how horrible it is there. And I said, well, what I think we should do is open a series of small full-service grocery stores around Jackson, like out in the country where they have no fresh vegetables or fruit in a store. They have chips, cigarettes, beer, right? That's it, bread. And he said, that's crazy, no. And so the next day I was sitting out in front of the art building at the University of Texas, and he came up and he said, here's what I think we ought to do. I think we ought to move back to Tennessee, go to Jackson, and open a series of small grocery stores surrounding the city. And let's retire when we're 30. I said, cool, let's go. So we did, and we did it. And his dad couldn't believe we would come back. And so here I am now, all of a sudden, I've quit grad school. I've turned down the other grad school. I'm now a grocery clerk in Jackson, Tennessee. People who are racist, just mind-boggling culture. And my motto for Jackson, which remains to this day, is Jackson, Tennessee, town where dreams go to die. And it was brutal. People were incredibly rude to us because we were boheme. The parents, my in-laws, were wonderful, darling humans. I love them dearly. And they ever judged us, never. And they did what we thought we should do. We opened five little grocery stores. We kept the central one and did this thing of, a deli in each one of them and so forth and so on. By the time it all worked, I had, that part of it worked, I had opened a little craft, I hesitate to call it a craft store. I opened a plant store. I was 25. I called it Green Ginger because there were streets in London named after whatever the ships were bringing in, so it could be Tobacco Lane or what have you. This one was Land of Green Ginger. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. I love that. So I took my return from IRS, my tax return, which was $300-something, bought that many plants to see if I, from a wholesaler, to see if I could keep them alive. And then the idea was I would have handmade everything and plants, like a basket to put the plant in, might be from Africa or China, wherever. And what I did not reckon on was in a community where people are a hair's breadth away from the farm and the poverty that may involve, they don't want handmade stuff. They want nice, shiny plastic, metal, whatever. They want to get away from all that. And so my clientele were from here, from Memphis. People came over and supported my business, and I didn't lose my shirt. I broke even. And most importantly, I got a business loan in my name at 25. I was in business for 2 years. I paid the loan off. I had a lot of interesting, very cool loot that I still have that hadn't sold in the time I was in business. And I had a credit in my name. So I decided, because I was dying from the neck up, as my dad would say, that I needed to leave. And I needed to go to the Art Academy and get going. Like, okay, I don't know enough to go to grad school, so I'm going to go to the Art Academy, learn everything, like more drawing, more design, more ceramic sculpture, whatever it was. And the underlying tale here is that the guy I was married to had become an addict and an alcoholic. And he was a coke addict. And so when I left, above every doorway on the molding were packets of Coke. And he was his father's business partner, had wads of cash every day from the grocery stores to take to the bank. There's only one person who knew how much that was, and it was 'twas he. So I told his parents, we're not going to make it. And he is an addict and in real trouble. But one of us is going to save selves. That's going to be me. I said, well, if you go to the Art Academy and you move to Memphis, you know this is the end of your marriage and your life here. And I said, yeah, I do. But I was 20, right at 28, almost 28. And I couldn't see a way out other than to just say, I'm out of here. And so I came to Memphis. I got in the Art Academy. I came to Memphis, and I had this goal. I was going to buy a house for a very minimal amount of money. Stephen Crump and his then-wife, Peggy, had bought a little house for something like $9,000 on Harvard. So I knew that, and he had been in my class at Southwestern. So I drove around down one street after another, lower midtown, you know, lower price, lower everything. And I saw a guy sitting out in front of an electric chartreuse house. And he looked kind of glum. And I said, hello, is this house for sale? Because it was clearly empty. And he said, well, it wasn't. But now it is. I bought it for my son, and he just flunked out of Memphis State today. And I'm pretty mad. And he said, what do you think about the color? I said, all wrong, really bad. He said, I was just trying to brighten it up. And I said, it's terrible. And he said, I says, how much would you take for it in cash tomorrow? And he said, really? And I said, yeah. Really? And he said, $10,000? So I went back to Jackson to the bank where the first woman bank director for First Tennessee in Tennessee was my banker. And I said, Mary Alice, I need $10,000. She said, for what? And I said, a house. She said, you can't borrow a down payment. I said, that's the whole thing. She said, holy cow, is it like in the just slums? And I said, no, but it's, you know, it's modest. I got the loan. I bought the house. I came back the next day with a cashier's check for 10 grand, gave it to this man. I mean, he didn't know me from Adam. I didn't know him. You know, all the stuff you think, where's your property, title search, and la, 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 la. I didn't know about that stuff. So there I was. I had a house. I had the loan. I had the house. I had the Art Academy. And I didn't know it, but a bunch of people on the street went to the Art Academy. So there began that life. So the trajectory was wild. Go to Europe, spend all your money going to Europe and hitchhiking. Come back with going, holy cow, what am I going to do? Go work in your family's grocery store as a clerk, for God's sakes. I thought, I'm going to die. This is my life. I am in a check stand. Good God, what has happened? And one of the few things that we could do that saved us from just being crazy was we had the Interesting Person of the Day Award. And whenever we were right off of I-40, when people would be doing the New York to L.A., boheme, flowered, you know, hipster bus, they'd stop. We were the first grocery store. And they would come in and they would be, you know, counting their little money and going, oh, God, this is scary. And then they'd see us and they were like, okay, we're going to be all right. And we would say, hello, congratulations, you've won the Interesting Person of the Day Award. All of your groceries will be free. And they would go, no, seriously. We said, seriously. But what about the owner? And we said, we are the owners. And they couldn't believe it. And it was so fun because, you know, they could get whatever they wanted. And they were rarely greedy. You know, they were modest. So we had this kind of crazy thing going on. And we lived in an antebellum house in a neighborhood that was very poor. It was just this gigantic brick mansion. And I saw it and went, wow, I want to live there. And we moved in. We had almost nothing. We're in the middle of this very poor neighborhood. A deputy sheriff lived right across the street. We could see downtown Jackson from our yard, and it had been used by Nathan Bedford Forrest as an office during the World War, during the Civil War, because it was so high. You could see all around. So it was a very screwball life, and lots of people from Memphis would come over for the weekend, and we had free groceries, right? So we fixed all kinds of great food. I came over here and bought Opera Memphis costumes when they had a big sale, and everybody would open the trunk in the hall and put on crazy dresses and uniforms and just wild outfits, and then have these meals that I cooked with all the great groceries we got for free. So, and the house was huge. It had, you know, like four bedrooms upstairs and so forth and so on. So it was a really crazy era of our lives. And the thing we did every year, every 6 months, we would take a trip somewhere because we were still addicted to that travel bug. And we went to South America, drove the same Chevy 2 station wagon to Miami, looked around, said we can't afford to put it in a parking garage, went up to a guy at a kind of repair place and said, "Hi, can we park here?" And he goes, "Yeah, well, for how long?" We said, "A couple of months." And he went, "Wow, really?" And we said, "Yeah, really." And he went, "Okay, but your car may not be here when you come back." We said, "Got it." You know. So we went to South America, and I bought stuff for my shop from all sorts of little towns. And we're in Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru, and did all this crazy stuff by going to government shops that had crafts from all over their country and carrying huge baskets on our head through the streets of big cities in those countries, and going to the middle of nowhere to buy bags and all kinds of baskets and whatever. And it was of course fabulous. And I speak Spanish pretty well, so it was easier. In those days, no one spoke English. No one, period. So we would go on these trips. At times I would get so exhausted mentally from speaking and living in another language all the time that I would just go, "I can't do this anymore. I got to stop." But we had amazing adventures. Like we were in Cusco, Peru, and we had been to Machu Picchu. We had done the classic walk up from a little town called Aguascalientes. That's now a snazzy place to stay, but then it was literally a hot spring from the Inca era that with these gigantic carved holes that you would get in, and they were full of water from the springs. And the Incas carved them. I mean, they were unbelievably huge, and kids from all over the world would be in there with you. So you'd be up to your neck in hot water, your feet dangling because they were really deep, like, you know, 15 feet deep. And this guy, Japanese, and these two kids are Italian. And then there's someone from China because we had just opened trade with China and so forth. Mm. Anyway, it was this wild era. And go to sleep that night in a big room with every language you can imagine being spoken. Anyone who had an instrument was playing music. And for 50 cents a person, you got a bed for two people. So you better hope you either like or know the person you're going to be in bed with. And so here, you know, 100 beds with 200 kids sleeping in them in this little village, and everybody gets up at dawn, pre-dawn, to watch sunrise at Machu Picchu. And you walk up the trail, the Inca Trail, and, you know, these are magical experiences, and I wouldn't trade them for anything. But again, you get back to your life, Jackson, Tennessee. Yeah, I could sell all those baskets and things like that, which I did. But I still had the art bug. Just, you know, it was, this is what I called it. It was like a dog that bites you on the ankle. Could either make a pet of it, tame it, brace it, make a pet of it, or shake it off. And I couldn't shake it off. Mm. So I was going to have to make a pet of it and embrace it and, you know, pursue the art again, not the green ginger. And I mean, people come in my store and go, "What is this?" And I said, "Well, it's a little store with handmade things from all over the world." "Well, why are you doing this?" I would go, "Yeah, good question," you know. But it all paid back because of setting up the credit, figuring out that I really did want to pursue more art education and so forth. And that I had tried that. I had traveled. I was ready for a different life.
Now, one thing that really strikes me, you know, as a teacher, is how often you failed. You know, how often there was something that happened that you realized wasn't right. And you were like, "Nope, Texas is not for me," or "Nope, Jackson is not for me." And I feel like for your generation, that's a really strange thing. Like, that sounds like something that this generation that, you know, I'm teaching now would do. You know, this idea that, you know, well, I started this, and, well, I married this person, and now I'm going to be married to them for 50 years, and then I'll die. Or, you know, I opened this store, and so I'm going to run this store until I die. And how often something happened, and you were like, "Nope, I need to do this other thing." And to me, that is really powerful and impactful and wholly alien to the other stories that I've heard, you know, from other people that are your generation, maybe not necessarily artists, but mm-hmm. other people, or maybe the generation before yours too. Well, okay, so that brings us to Memphis. And so you get to Memphis, and then if I remember right, last time when we were talking, you mentioned a bunch of people. You talked a lot about, or not a lot, but you talked at length about Ted Fairs and working with him. Now, you also mentioned a few other people, and I just wanted to give you a chance, if you wanted to backtrack and mm-hmm. maybe talk a little bit more in depth about them, or maybe omission is the perfect way of saying that it wasn't good. And so if that is the case, you can just skip right over them. So you mentioned Vita, Bob Reisling, John Seyfried, and Peter Sanjin, and John McIntyre. Uh-huh. Are any of those people stick out in your brain as people that would be worth going back and talking about a little bit more?
Yeah, I'd say so. And briefly as well, like Vita Reed was the first person I had who, in a sense, gave me permission to draw the way I drew. I was not, am not a realistic drawer. I like, you know, contour drawing is my favorite, and that just the way it feels and loose and so forth. And she said, "Yeah, it's great. Do that." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Really? Yeah, pursue that." And then Bob Reisling, who I had later, you know, a year or so later, was going, yeah, go with this. This is powerful stuff. Go. And his class, some of my classmates were I thought knuckleheads, but big surprise. I mean, you're going to have people you like and people you don't. Dolph was another teacher I had, Dolph Smith, and he was kind of scared of some of the art stars in our class. And I can remember saying, Dolph, this guy is totally playing you, man. He didn't do that assignment. He just did other stuff and brought this bullshit in and pretends in this intellectual way that he did this process. It was really not a process. It was a baloney. And Dolph is like, he was innocent in a strange way. He was naive and didn't know how to even take that. And it wasn't just me. It was a group of students who just said, stop letting this man play you because he's an idiot. Come on. And so then I'm in Peter Sonjan's class. Those were all drawing, painting with fairs and so forth. Then I'm in Peter's class, and he, I think I mentioned this last time, he said, okay, I do low firework. And I grew up in a Latin culture, San Antonio. Mm-hmm. Then here I go to Mexico, I'm in South America, et cetera. I'm immersed in culture that uses low fire, low temperature, in other words, and colorful, very, very colorful. So here's the era of what everybody called, oh, you're not going to do that brown pottery, are you? But no, I don't even know how to throw, and I don't want to know how to throw. I don't care about that. I want to make sculptures. And Sonjan said, why are you here? I said, are you kidding me? I'm here because I want to be a ceramic sculpture major. And he said, I don't know anything about that. Go to Memphis State and take classes with Nancy and Niles, which I did.
Now, just out of curiosity, just to like backtrack a little bit. So Dolph, for me, I only know Dolph sort of tangentially, and I'm not sure if I've ever had a real long conversation with him. Usually, like I think the longest I talked to him was when he had that book show at the Brooks. And that thing that you said about him being kind of naive, like for me, there is something kind of innocent about the way that he talks. Not like he's yes. simple or anything like that, but like there is such a eyes open kind of ness to him where you get a sense that he is without cynicism, you know? And how did that translate for you as a student?
I respected him tremendously, and I knew he was a very successful artist. In terms of those days, it was barns, you know, and old buildings and so forth. But he sold everything he made and had a wife who was a nurse and three really interesting kids, all of whom are not like that. Mm-hmm. You know, Allison, who's the one artist out of them, is so simpatico with her dad. But that kind of reticence, in a sense, or he does lack that cynicism, which I think is beautiful and great. And he's not a simpleton by any stretch. And he has a hard time getting his ideas across to a group of students. He's telling us, bring out the color by just making the marks harder and darker and closer together. Go, okay, yeah, I got it. Okay, so see, if you're doing rain and you want to show da-da-da, yeah, la-la-la. Yeah, okay, got it. So he was a very good teacher, but I always thought he was, I didn't think he was clueless, but I thought sometimes that innocence was annoying. Mm. And people like Ted Fairs, who was a gentle person, very gentle in the sense that Dolph is. But Ted, you knew that there was this behind it. With Dolph, it was more like gentleness that was, you could poke it, and it was soft and fluffy. Mm. And with Fairs, it was quite different. And Sonjan was tough. If anybody came out of his department, you were going to know everything and you were going to be able to make a living on your pottery. And I thought, wow, I am lost here. This is going to be really hard. But to his great credit, let me do it. And he, you know, to suggest that I go and work with Niles and Nancy, which was really good. They were both fairly new at U of M at those days. But I was around a whole bunch of other people who were making, you know, Nancy was making these crazy sculptural things. And Niles was only doing pottery then, but exquisite pottery. He's a very, very superb thrower. And
now, was there overlap? I mean, I think one thing that I remember sort of about the MCA U of M connection was that there wasn't one, you know, that it really was a sort of a boundary. And unless we intentionally entered the world of MCA as University of Memphis students, we were really like wholly unaware of them. Was there a time or in that time with you, like you were saying, Sanjin said to go over there, and that's totally amazing to me that you would be like, oh, okay, MCA is not working, so I'm going to go to the U of M.
I was in both simultaneously.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, was there overlap? Was there a connection and between the two institutions at that time?
Not really. In an informal sense, Sanjin, Nancy, and Niles all graduated from the same art school.
Oh, okay.
And so they knew each other, not as friends, but they knew each other, and that they had gone to Alfred and had Robert Turner was one of the big, big stars in the ceramics world. And because they shared something, and I could take classes and I would get credit at the Art Academy for them. And so it was Niles and Nancy knew that I was not a full-time student at U of M. I was at the Art Academy, but they knew why, and they encouraged me, and it was good. And
now, what did you notice about differences between the two institutions? Because you were there in the graduate program or in the ceramics facilities. How did it seem different, how did it seem the same to you?
I thought that probably the Art Academy generally had a smart alecky attitude about Memphis State, and that in fact there were wonderful faculty there, and I took a lot of art history there. When I ended up going to grad school at Memphis University of Memphis, there were amazing teachers. I didn't quite get a master's in art history or in sculpture because I did them at the same time, and I just bottomed out. Here, another failure. Did you ever have, she was a nun.
Carol Pirtle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I duked it out with that woman, man. I thought, I'm going to beat you at your fucking game. This is ridiculous. And she was so hard on me because I wouldn't bend. Maybe I would bend, but I wouldn't break. And I always felt like she was trying to get me to break and do it her way. And she told me one time when I decided to quit grad school, I was doing my business. You know, when you worked for me, I quit because I didn't have time. I thought, wait a second, wait. Why am I going to grad school if I already have a business that I'm doing all the time and I'm making not a big living but a petite living as an artist? Why am I doing this other thing? This is stupid. Why am I doing it when this woman has the gall to say to me, this class it's not going to enhance your life. It's not going to, in the sense, what it's going to do is it's going to interrupt your life. I said, excuse me, Dr. Pirtle, I have a full-time job and I'm running my own studio, and I don't quite get it. How I'm going to have time? You said the first week we would have 10 hours of reading, second week 15, 20, 25 until we get up to around 35 hours a week of reading. Are you kidding me? What am I going to do? Not sleep? And, you know, other people in the class were going, oh, my God, how are we going to do this? This is so terrible, blah, blah, blah. And her answer was almost always the same thing. Mr. Forrest, see me after class. You know, that's like the kiss of death comment. See me. Because they're going to say, yeah, tune in. Either get in or get out, you know. But I thought that what I got from Niles and Nancy was so important. And that it's to Peter's also his great credit that he took his ego of being, I'm the art star, I'm an incredible potter. He just went, okay, that doesn't work with this person. I'm going to tell her what will work. And, you know, to send me on my way. And that was huge. And I was glad I had the opportunity to be in both places simultaneously because I could see that there were certainly people as good as anybody at the Art Academy. The main difference in those days, which is did not continue until the school closed, was that we were in drawing for 6 hours a day. I mean, I think some of the classes there are long, are they not?
They are, but if I remember right, you mean 6 hours and that's the week? Or do you mean 6 hours per meeting and it's twice a week?
I think it was once a week.
Okay, yeah. So ours is like that, but we break it. So okay. Ours is Tuesday, Thursday, or Monday, Wednesday,
and
3 hours per session.
Which I think is good. Because 6 hours, you know, after about four and a half, people just, all of a sudden you're looking around and you go, where's everybody?
Right.
Because they've had it. You know, they're tapped out. But the Art Academy... Those classes were long, but Niles and Nancy were good about allowing me to do both. You know, both of the I had different. You know, couldn't take Peter's class and turn in my stuff to Niles and Nancy. It was Peter's class, Niles' class, Nancy's class. You know, three different sets of stuff that I had to produce, but it was connected, you know, and so it was, they pushed me a lot, and my classmates at the Art Academy really pushed me. At Memphis State, they didn't so much. Mm-hmm. They were mostly like, ooh, what's this? This is a unicorn over here. It's not exactly a Memphis student. It's not exactly an Art Academy person, but it's somebody who... you know, is doing both. And I had the opportunity, therefore, to know what Southwestern, the Art Academy, and U of M had in their art department. Who was there? What did they expect? What did, you know, what were my peers like? And so forth. And it was good. That was powerful.
Now, thinking about U of M or Memphis State at the time, thinking about that, you and Niles and Nancy are almost contemporaries in terms of your age, in terms of your place in the world.
Yeah.
And then also, like, thinking about that thing that you were talking about with going back to school or being in school while you're doing these other things, and how, for some people, that's a really difficult thing to do, to kind of check your ego at the door and to take advice in an academic setting from people who are your contemporaries. Was that pretty seamless for you, or was that tricky?
It was seamless because I have a theory that if you're gonna go into, like, for instance, I want to take an encaustic workshop from someone in a couple of weeks now, and I've done that before, and I've done a bunch of encaustic pieces, but my theory is the way to do it, which is what I did at Memphis State and the Art Academy, was to, I have never done this before in my life. I'm going to listen. I'm going to learn. I'm not going to say, excuse me, what about this? You're completely leaving that out. And therefore, you learn a lot more.
Right.
The people that put their ego on their shoulder, they're, you know, here, it's going to get knocked off. You know that. And you want to say, Yes, we have to have an ego to have the gall to spend your life doing something like this that may bring you nothing. I mean, I used to tell students when I was the admissions director at the Art Academy, if you were in med school or law school or business school, you would know that when you finish, got this out there for your J-O-B. Mm-hmm. When you go here, what, are you lazy? Are you hardworking? Are you a graphic designer? Are you a sculptor or painter? I mean, come on. I don't know. That's when I knew I needed to quit being the admissions director, when a kid would say, so, ma'am, what will I be making when I graduate? Say, what is your name? Hamlet. Hamlet, I've been in this room with you for 28 minutes. I don't know you, but I know you told me you're a painter. Are you a lazy guy? Are you hardworking? Do you have kids? Do you have responsibilities at home? Do you need to work full-time to be able to afford to be in school? And did you want, what, the killer sound system, Oriental rugs, and a great car? And they would go, yeah. And I would say, okay, good luck. Better be a graphic designer, because that's where your lies. You're going to be a painter or a sculptor. God help you, man. And, you know, they would freak. And I thought, I better get out of this.
Right. Now, just out of curiosity, just to sort of like break it down the way that we kind of broke down and thought about the other teachers. So for me, Nancy, as a teacher, I had her probably when she was in her 40s or maybe 50s as a teacher. This was in the mid-90s. And Nancy was kind of like an unwavering voice of support. You know, like she was always, yeah, do that, or yeah, push that, or try this, or try that. What was it? What was Nancy like for you as a teacher?
So different. That
okay.
I think the fact that we were the same age, and her personality when I had her, she was probably 30, 28, whatever. I was 28, so she was about 28. She was hesitant and shy and wouldn't like, come on, Nancy, come on, let's go, let's speak up. And she always looked at me like this, like she didn't get me. And I mean, I still know her and I still think we are like, she was never discouraging, never. And Niles really pushed. And, I mean, he was cocky and smart-alecky and was like, get in here, sister, and do some more work. And I would get frozen on some little precious something-something. And he was like, come on, come on. And Nancy would be just sort of cocking her head like she just didn't get me. And it's okay, you know. I was grateful that I had the other two clay people to bounce off of. And her work is so odd to me that it's not surprising that we were, and a person that was weirdly helpful to me at the state was Harris Sorrell. And I think, did I mention him to you before? He, you know how we, in the days when we had, I guess I was in grad school by then, we had, you know, the oversight committee came in and looked at your work and so forth. And Larry Edwards said, a la Niles, literally he said this, you need to either go or get off the pot. Do more work, you know, come on. And Harris was on the same committee, and he said, well, notice that all your work, which was in those days mostly houses or buildings, is the size of your head. To me, they reveal what's in there. And I think you're on a good track here. Keep going. And that resonated with me more than go or get off the pot. And Larry's work, I admired Larry very much, but I hated his work. And Harris Sorrell's work was not work that I love, but I, you know, I was a decent guy. And so it was a contrast of Niles and his smart alecky push, Nancy and her very reticent, like, yikes, I don't know what the heck this person is up to, but go for it, sister. I mean, you know, keep going. I mean, I can just see her so clearly standing in my little space, just kind of going like this.
Right, cocking her head.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, for me, the thing that I like hearing when you're talking about that is thinking about the different points of view and how important those different points of view can be to forming a kind of whole education. You know, I think one of the things that I'm really sad about at the U of M right now is that we only have one ceramicist, you know, like how we went from having two to one.
Who is it?
Kate Roberts.
Okay.
And Kate is great, and she's a really terrific high-energy teacher, or rather, I think she's a pretty chill teacher, but she's a really high-energy motivator. And so that's really good, but also one of the things I love about U of M is that Kate is in the building with Kelsey, who's teaching sculpture, and how, like, you know, all of us are able to have our personalities where, like, when I was teaching at Rhodes, they were three of us, you know, and we kind of had to be all things to all people. And I like hearing you talk about how everyone is kind of different. If we could, in the time that we've got left, I know we just covered that tiny little bit of time, but that was really good. Will you talk a little bit about the starting of the business and how you decided to start the business that you were doing when you were in grad school?
I had the opportunity. One of the people I met in Jackson is a woman named Sherry Hunt. When we met, she said, "My brother's an artist. He does sculpture. You would like each other." And he was just graduating from Otis at the time, Brian Hunt. And so I said, "Oh, cool. I'd like to meet him." Blah, blah. So I met him, and he became an art star and in New York and showed at Blumhelmann and sold everything he made. He did these waterfall pieces in bronze and so forth and so on. Anyway, called me and said, "Hey, do you want to come and babysit my loft and my apartment for 3 months while I go to Spain and work for a few months?" And I said, "Yeah." And sure, yeah. And at the time, I thought, yikes. I mean, money-wise, how am I going to pull this off? What am I going to be doing? La, la, la. A month later, he called me, and I was supposed to teach. I had taught a class, 3D design at Rhodes for Lon while he was away. Then he wanted me to teach in the fall. And I also got a McDowell grant for the fall. And so then meanwhile, here's Brian Hunt offering me his studio and all this space. And I'm thinking, how can I pull this off? So then Lon called me and said, I told McDowell I couldn't do it because I had a teaching opportunity, but I'd reapply. Lon calls and says, "Your job has been terminated, and a guy named Jim Williamson, who's an architect who's been working with Robert Venturi, is moving back to Memphis." And I said, "What does that have to do with my job?" And he said, "Well, you know, he's an architect. He's a 3D guy. He's just setting up his practice, and he needs to support his family." I said, "Are you kidding me? He's married to a woman who's a full-time educator. They have no children. What the hell are you talking about? What about me? I just turned down a fucking McDowell Colony grant and told this guy, Brian Hunt, that I needed to maybe wait before I did this gig." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but that's the decision that's been made. Doesn't this make you feel better?" I could not believe it. I remember that my reaction was to put on Janis Joplin's "Take a Little Piece of My Heart" and just sit in my car listening to it, screaming and screaming and screaming. I was so mad. Here is the person that's my mentor, hired me to teach his class while he was away, then commits to having me teach there again in the fall, and then takes the rug out from under me. How could he do this? And so Brian Hunt then calls and says, my assistant Lois had a fire in her apartment. She needs to live in my space this summer. So let's just put it on hold for a year. So I thought, well, at least that's, you know, blah, blah, blah. So what am I going to do? I'm completely freaked out. I go to a catering company and be a cook for a year. Save. And I then go to New York to stay at Brian Hunt's loft, which was number 9 White Street. David Sally lived upstairs. His girlfriend at the time, Carol Armitage, who's a brilliant choreographer, lived with him. And little did I know, but Jeff Neeson lived across the street from me, which we found out years later. Anyway, so I'm there, and Brian, this is what I'm supposed to do. Fire his new kiln, do some test glazes and clays, and water his plants. Like, okay. So I made some, I thought, now what am I going to do for a living? I had been working with food, so I started doing all of these vegetable-related plates. And I said, okay, I'm gonna bite the bullet. I'm going to do some cast plates. It's going to be Peter Sonjan, roll in your, you know, wheelchair. You're going to, here I am. And I made a series of pieces, went, took them around to 26 galleries, shops, stores, what have you, all over New York. I was told 26 times no. And I was upset. I mean, it was getting to be August. I'm like, holy cow, what am I going to do? For God's sakes, I don't, you know, yikes. My idea was, when I had the shop in Jackson, people would say, the people that were sophisticated enough or interested enough to like what I had would go, oh, you know, I saw these in New York, and now you have them here. In other words, instant credibility. Mm. And so I thought, if I can get a store in New York to carry my work, then I'll go to Market in Dallas, where I had purchased things for my little shop. So I had a little bit of familiarity with it for a few years of going to Market. And people will say, oh, where do you show your work? And I'll say, oh, I have it at La 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 in New York. Go, oh, cool. That was my goal. So 26 no's. And I came back one day, and I was, and Carol Armitage was standing there at the elevator waiting to go up to her place. And she said, oh, man, did New York beat you up again today? And I said, yeah, I'm so upset. I can't get a toehold. And she said, do not let the city beat you. Keep going. Keep going. If this is what you need or want to do, you got to keep going. Get up tomorrow and say, different day, I'm going to go again. The next day, I went back to a little gallery that sold Latin American things. I had a piece on little pennies at a time, kind of paying for it. And I said to the guy that was there, Alberto Ortega, I said, I'd like to make an appointment with the owner or buyer or what have you to show my ceramic dinnerware. And he said, is it in that, your portfolio? And I said, it is. And he said, I'm the owner, show me. And I said, can we make an appointment? And he said, show me now. Are you too busy? And I said, no. And he said, okay, show me now. So I open it up and I lay out the plates, the pepper plates, the vegetable plates, the one-of-a-kind things. And he goes, do you throw? And I said, I do not. I cast these. And he said, okay, have a pen and paper? He says, okay, four of these, six of those. Do you make platters? How about cups? How about this? How about that? And he ordered $400 worth of stuff. And I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. So he said, is it FOB Memphis? Uh-huh. I had no idea what that meant. Is it net 30? And I said, yeah. In other words, I'll pay you in 30 days. And I had no idea what that meant. But I thought, I'm on a roll here. Mm-hmm. This is it. We're going to go. And I went back, called my dad, and said, hey, would you bankroll me to the Dallas market in a month? And he said, how much is it? And I said, it's $1,200 for a booth. And I just got my first order in New York. And he said, yes, I will pay it. And he did. And then I went to Dallas with one of everything. One. And although I was filling Alberto's order for his shop with whatever I had. Oh, no, I can't sell my samples. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I getting into? And I got $3,000 worth of orders. So that's started it.
All right, let's pause there. Good Lord.
And that was the second of three interviews with Carol DeForest. Please join us next week with another interview. Spoiler alert, it is the third of three interviews. Until then, thank you for listening.